Hello and welcome to Top of the Progs on Smile Radio and also broadcasting on and in association with Progzilla Radio. You're currently listening to Canaria by Emerson, Lake and Palmer. I hope you enjoy it. Wonderful Canaria from the much maligned and much hated Love Beach album by Emerson, Lake and Palmer. For those all of you unaware, that is the album where they are shirtless on a beach with palm trees in the background, looking like a sad rip-off of the Bee Gees. Anyway, hello and welcome to Top of the Progs on Smile Radio and also broadcasting on and in association with Progzilla Radio. Now, as I said, Love Beach is probably one of the most hated prog rock albums of all time. It comes up a lot in the jokes of what's the worst prog rock album. Oh, what's a sellout album and all that kind of stuff. But it has some good moments on there, in my opinion. And Canario is definitely one of them. It's One of ELP's lesser-known classical adaptations. I had the joy of seeing Carl Palmer do this in concert with his ELP Legacy Band about a couple of years ago, and that was just absolutely smashing hearing him rock through the tune live. I watched a great review of it where the reviewer Notes Review said that the song is kind of like what you'd expect the theme tune for a kid's 70s game show to be, and I was like, yeah, I can understand that criticism, but I really enjoy it. Next up, we got a little bit from UK's second album, 1979's Danger Money. 1979's Danger Money. It's amazing how fast bands worked back in those days. You see, UK formed in late 1977. In April 1978, the debut album came out, did a massive tour, and then, like, in April the next year, 1979, a whole new album with a new drummer and new songs was out, and it was amazing that. I don't know what it was back then. Maybe times were different, I guess. Times were different. There were more albums, lots more albums, lots more often. But anyway, this is probably the best track, and it starts with an amazing drum solo from the one and only Terry Bozzio. This is The Only Thing She Needs by UK.
Oh,
one of UK's finest moments there. It's such a great track. I love how it starts, love how it kind of kicks in. It's so kind of well made, you know. It kind of introduces Terry Bozzio perfectly to the band. It's just like, it's, you know, people wondering who's this guy that's replacing Bill Bruford. Terry Bozzio shows you exactly who he is within the first few seconds of that song and what he's capable of. And he just lays down some mean grooves on the whole album. His playing on Danger Money is phenomenal. I've never really heard anything quite like it. He has the kind of intricacies of what Bruford was doing, but he's kind of got the powerhouse technical thing. He kind of overplays a lot, but it works because they're just a three-piece at this point. He doesn't need to hold back and restrain so that other instruments can come forward, because it's just keyboards, bass and drums, and it just works really well as a combo. I think as an album, Danger Money I might prefer it over the first UK album, because it feels just kind of that bit more kind of cohesive, if that makes sense, as an entire album and as a piece of work with how it sounds and what the songs are like. But nonetheless, it's absolutely brilliant. Moving on to another kind of slightly controversial prog rock album, we're going with the Yes Is Drama album. This is Yes featuring the Buggles, basically, for all of you those who don't know. It's Steve Howe, Alan White, Chris Squire, augmented by Jeff Downes on keyboards and Trevor Horn on vocals. Basically, Rick Wakeman and John Anderson left the band or got fired, whatever, after Tomato. And they carried on doing the Drama album, except with the Buggles. And it's a really, really good album. It's one of those where you could put points of it on. You could put parts of Machine Messiah on, with the high harmonies, and you wouldn't be able to tell. If you didn't tell somebody that John Anderson wasn't on there, you'd never heard Yes before. If you played, for example, maybe a bit of Going for the One and then just kind of slid into Machine Messiah, people would be hard-pressed to instantly pick up on the fact that it's a new lead singer and a new keyboardist. Now, one of the things I really like about the Drama album is that, as much as I love Rick Wakeman, he overplays a lot, and I mean a hell of a lot. He leaves no space in a lot of his music. He was quite tasteful on Fragile, but when we got to Close to the Edge, every single second and corner of music is being filled by Rick Wakeman. He's always doing a widdly solo or a widdly lead line, and that's just how he is. It's amazing and it works, but it's Rick Wakeman's signature. But on the Drama album, Jeff Downes pulls back a little bit, and he just does kind of rhythm keys, you know, he just kind of supports what Steve Howe is doing with some really nice chord playing, and it allows the drumming of Alan White and Steve Howe's guitars to shine through just that little bit more than it used to do, which makes the album really interesting. But anyway, this is Into the Lens by Yes.
How you lose Here, where the lens is wide, you and me by the sea, taken in tranquility. We'll be right back.
See, that one's it's a good bit of fun. You've got the cool kind of Squire bass line opening it out, and then it goes into this weird Steve Howe weavy guitar thing. It's just a great song. It's really fun to listen to. Yeah, the Drama album has become one of my favourite Yes albums. I get the kind of same buzz off that now. When I was younger, I used to listen to Yes a lot. I had basically the classic era, basically on record. So I had the Yes album, Fragile, Close to the Edge, Topographic Oceans, Relayer, Going for the One. And I just used to go through those, like, literally in order, like, for most days for quite a long period of time, or I'd listen to one out of that sequence and really enjoy it. And I got Tomato eventually, and I listened to it once and thought it was so, it was a bit naff. But that kind of classic run of albums, I just never really broke out of that ever. Obviously, I heard tracks like Owner of a Lonely Heart, I heard the song Time and a Word, and a few other kind of Yes songs here and there, but that was the kind of, that was Yes for me, it was those albums. And discovering Drama at the start of this year, it was kind of like a revelation. It was kind of like, you know, if I'd have heard this back then, it would have gone toe-to-toe with the others, and it still did. I got the same buzz discovering Drama and listening to that for the first few times that I got discovering those other Yes albums back in the day. Moving on now to a bit of 80s King Crimson. It's one of the most original songs, in my opinion, that the band did. This is one of those really interesting ones where all the elements gel together of the band, and maybe this is like one of their signature tracks. It's got the intricate rhythm guitariness that Fripp's doing and Ballou are doing. It's got the lead guitar weirdness. It's got the Bill Bruford breaking time and doing whatever the hell he wants. And it's got a really weird vocal, which was a letter that Adrian Ballou got from his wife about like a vase that she'd made. And he just like removed a bunch of the lines and read it. And it created something really spooky and really cool and really menacing. This is Indiscipline by King Crimson.
I do remember one thing. It took hours and hours, and by the time I was done with it, I was so involved, I didn't know what to think. I carried it around with me for days and days, playing little games, like not looking at it for a whole day, and then looking at it to see if I still liked it. I did! I repeat myself when under stress. The more I look at it, the more I like it. I do think it's good. The fact is, no matter how closely I study it, no matter how I take it apart, no matter how I break it down, it remains consistent. I wish you were here to see it!
Just something weird and kind of freaky about what Adrian Belew's doing there that kind of makes it really kind of exciting. It's got this unsettling kind of horrible edge to it, and it just makes it really fun, and it's just so weird. Bruford is just kind of doing whatever the hell he wants. He's just kind of breaking time, he's ignoring what everybody else is doing and just creating some absolute chaos. He's roughly kind of keeping the beat, but at the same time he's just going absolutely crazy and going all over the place, but it's a really fun one. Next up we've got a little bit of something a bit lighter and something a little bit different after all that. We've got maybe what is Lou Reed's signature songs, one of the most famous bass lines of all time, created by the wonderful Herbie Flowers. Now, to create this bass line, Herbie basically did it because he wanted a little bit more money, which is very cheeky of him. See, in those days, in the dark, distant early 70s, musicians were paid for overdubs, basically. So for every single part they would add in, they were paid for it. And Herbie put this really nice double bass line down on Walk on the Wild Side and thought, oh, this sounds really good, maybe I can get more money if I put an electric bass on it as well. So he overdubbed an electric bass, doing the high notes, doing like a harmony note of the root of the chord, and he created one of the most magical bass lines of all time. This is Walk on the Wild Side by Lou Reed.
Holly came from Miami, FLA. Hitchhiked her way across USA. Plucked her eyebrows on the way. Shaved her legs and then he was a she. She says, hey babe, take a walk on the wild side. Said, hey honey, take a walk on the wild side. She was everybody's darling, but she never lost her head. Even when she was given head, she says, hey babe, take a walk on the wild side. Said, hey babe, take a walk on the wild side. And the colored girls go doo 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 doo. Gave it away. Everybody had to pay and pay. A hustle here and a hustle there. New York City is the place where they said, hey babe, take a walk on the wild side. I said, hey Joe, take a walk on the wild side. Sugar Plum Fairy came and hit the streets, looking for soul food and a place to eat. Went to the Apollo, you should have seen him go, go, go. They said, hey, sugar, take a walk on the wild side. I said, hey, babe, take a walk on the wild side. All right. Ha. Jackie is just speeding away. Thought she was James Dean for a day. Then I guess she had to crash. Valium would have helped that fast. I said, hey, babe, take a walk on the wild side. I said, hey, honey, take a walk on the wild side. And the colored girls say, doo 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 doo.
It's such a good song. It's so kind of so kind of chill and relaxing, and the bass line is just so sweet. No matter how many times I've heard that song, I never get tired of what Herbie's doing in that song. And I love how Herbie openly admits that he just did it for more money. Well, I guess one of the interesting things about that song, and it goes back to the whole thing of, you know, who contributes what to music, is that Herbie Flowers never got any royalties for that song. He just got a one-off payment to do that bass line, and yeah, he didn't get anything. He didn't get anything extra or anything like that for doing, you know, for every time the song has been played. And a lot of people would say that's the kind of defining feature of the track, is that bass line. And he should have maybe gotten a few extra quid from it. But it was the 70s. No one knew about royalties and how this all would kind of work and pan out further down the line. But yeah, such a brilliant tune. Next up, we've got one of The Who's signature songs. It's one of those that's been played loads of times, but I absolutely love it. One of my favourite The Who facts, which I learned recently from listening to the audiobook of Roger Daltrey's autobiography, thanks a lot, Mr. Kibblewhite, was that Roger Daltrey hates listening to his own music. Specifically, he hates listening back to the music of The Who. He said, if I'm at a party and you put The Who on, I'm off, I'm going home, which I just thought was really funny. I could just imagine him, you know, someone puts Barbara O'Reilly on and he goes, oh, sod it, I'm going home now, I'm not listening to this. But I thought it was quite an interesting insight from him. But this is a song that Roger particularly doesn't like, which is really bizarre when I play it, because you'll all go, he doesn't like this? Roger has always said of the song that because it has a loop going through it, because they have to stick rigidly to the loop and to the click track, that he's never allowed to take liberties with it. And it's a long song, and he says people always want to hear the whole thing. It'd be better if it was shorter. And he said he enjoys the kind of off-the-cuff, spontaneous moments of live improvisation, but there are really no such points to do this in this song, and he feels like he's tied to it. He said he wasn't really a fan of it when he did it, and he's even less so now, which is strange, but hey-ho, he sang it, he can give whatever opinion he wants. This is Won't Get Fooled Again by The Who.
Thank you.
It's just one of the greats, in my opinion. Though kind of, it's just, I don't know how to describe it. I can sort of understand why Daltrey dislikes it, but at the same time, I think it's just absolutely wonderful. It's kind of almost, it's almost a definitive song in a way, because it's got the kind of, it's got the really obvious kind of political message in it. You know, it's kind of the sad downbeat message thing that, although, you know, the protesting and all that kind of hippie stuff happened in the 60s, ultimately it changed nothing, is kind of the message of that song. You know, meet the new boss, the same of the old boss. You just think, wow, that is dark, man. That's some dark lyrics there by Townsend. It's so cynical, but yeah, kind of appropriate and accurate. But I love that song. Next up, we've got a little bit of Megadeth with one of the biggest songs from the band's, maybe the biggest album, 1990s, Rust in Peace. Rust in Peace is an interesting album. It's the kind of perfect closer to the 80s, is what kind of some people have described it as. You know, all the kind of thrash of the 80s, it comes to a head with Rust in Peace. It's kind of almost one of those definitive thrash albums before everything changed. It was just before Metallica went slow and melodic, and just before they sold out, according to critics, with the Black Album. But Rust in Peace, again, is one of those kind of great examples of the band just being on fire at this point. They've got two new members for this album. They've got Nick Menza on drums, making his debut, and they've also got Marty Friedman on guitar. Marty Friedman's guitar work on the album is just phenomenal. Like, his lead work is just unbelievable. His solos are kind of so melodic and kind of so catchy and just pull you in, and it just makes for a really kind of really great piece of music. And Dave Mustaine's vocals were really good at this point. He's got such a distinct, horrific style that kind of reached the peak on this album, as well as his rhythm playing. But anyway, this is Tornado of Souls by Megadeth.
Hanging out by water.
See, what I really like about that is just it's so kind of relentless. The intro is kind of such an earworm. The chord progression is almost punky. You can almost imagine a punk track having that chord progression, but the way it's kind of dealt and done with the vocals just makes it instant Megadeth and instant heavy metal, which is again one of the other reasons why I adore that song. So we're now going to end the show now with another slice, believe it or not, of 80s King Crimson. I kind of did this by accident, but it's a great song. So this is like the title track from the third album of the band's 80s trilogy. The 80s trilogy of the band is really interesting because, of course, it starts with Discipline, which, from all accounts, was a good album. It was a good time working out. And then Beat, where kind of most of the arguments started, and then Three of a Perfect Pair, in which the kind of group was starting to fall apart. Fripp realised he didn't want to. He found himself back in the same spot he did in 74. There was lots of arguments. He didn't want to do King Crimson anymore, and he was really kind of unsure of what to do, basically. But it resulted, you know, the tension, it created some great music, some all-time classics. In the 80s era of King Crimson is one of my favourites of the band. It's so different, it's a total reinvention. And for that reason, I think it works. This is Three of a Perfect Pair by King Crimson. Thank you all for listening. I hope you have a good week. Goodbye.